I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. The nutrition diva, Monica Reinagel, joins me for another installment of Smart Nutrition. Today, a conversation about keeping kids healthy and hydrated during the hazy and often lazy days of summer. Results from a big study about the effectiveness of the Mediterranean diet are recalled and retooled. We'll talk about the new conclusions, and calcium supplements are among the best-selling dietary and nutrition supplements in an industry that takes in close to $32 billion a year. New research draws a connection between calcium supplements and colon polyps that could develop into cancer. Plus, if you're trying to shed a few pounds, there's an app for that. Do you know what your nutrition GPA is? The Nutrition Diva takes your calls and comments when Midday starts right after the news. The peas. Good afternoon, everybody. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to begin today with a correction. I am very indebted to our friends at Save Your Soul, who pinged me on Facebook the last time we played this song, which I incorrectly identified as being by James Brown. It is not. I am ashamed, embarrassed, and astounded. It is by the JBs. That's not James Brown, but the backup band for James Brown. It dates from 1972. James Brown wrote the piece along with Charles Bobbitt and John Starks, but it's the JBs, not James Brown himself. And by the way, Save Your Soul, I'm very indebted to you for the correction. And they have an event coming up July 6th at the Lithuanian Hall on Holland Street in Baltimore with DJ Mad Squirrel from DC. And we've got a link to info about that event on the Midday website. So now to the business at hand, again, with thanks to Save Your Soul. Today, it's another edition of Smart Nutrition, which is why we play Pass the Peas with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagel. Good to see you.
Happy Wednesday.
Happy Wednesday to you. So if you are looking to improve your eating habits, perhaps the most important first step is to track what you're eating. Data is everything. And if you're tracking what you eat with an app, the New York Times recently featured four apps that do a good job. We'll talk about those. And another piece in the New York Times that caught our eye. It's a report that raises questions about one of the most well-known and popular diets out there, the Mediterranean diet. It appears that a big study that evaluated the Mediterranean diet was flawed. So, Monica, we're going to ask you to explain that, if you wouldn't mind. Also, we're going to hear about kids experiencing, a lot of times we do hear about kids experiencing summer slides. In other words, losing ground academically when school is out for the summer. But for lots of kids, summer is also time when their nutrition habits slide. So Monica's going to have some tips about keeping them on track for their healthy hiatus. And a new study suggests that there may be a link between calcium supplements and colon disease. So lots of folks take calcium supplements, but how big is the upside of doing that? Monica Reinagel is an author and a licensed nutritionist who blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. We are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. You can give us a tweet at @MiddayWIPR. You can send us an email, midday@WIPR.org. And you can give us a call, the good old-fashioned human-to-human contact way, 410-662-8780. So we have talked a lot about these apps that are, you know, related to dieting and nutrition and stuff. They really are helpful. I mean, it just as a general thing, because there's something about sort of keeping track of what you're doing that's sort of at the basis of all what you need to do.
Right. They say you only manage what you measure, and that turns out to be true. And, you know, before we had apps and smartphones, nutrition consultants used to have their clients track what they were eating with a, wait for it, pen and paper.
Yeah,
and it
those.
Worked just as well that way, too. You know, it turns out that when you take a moment to write down everything that you're eating, it raises your consciousness a little bit. And it also gathers some really important information that you can use to help modify your choices to get them closer to whatever your goals are. So,
and there's also a thing, a lot of folks share their progress with other people, their Facebook pages and groups. And you even have some groups on your blog where there's something about, you know, if you say you have a goal to lose 10 pounds and, and you get in a group with other people who have the same goal and you, you know, send messages to each other. Well, today I did great. I lost a pound or something like that. That helps too.
Yeah, there's that social support and a little bit of accountability there. And sometimes people are motivated by a feeling of competitiveness, you know? We see this a lot in workplace wellness challenges where they will set it up sort of as a contest or a competition. You know, my favorite way for them to do that is maybe pit one location against another location or, you know, one department.
The Bethesda office against Silver Spring. Yeah.
And not have it turn into a who can lose the most weight in the shortest amount of time, because I don't really feel like that is, you know, in anybody's best interests. But yeah, a little friendly competition, and you're pulling, you're not just working for yourself, you're working for the team, you know, can also motivate people. Yeah.
So there are these four apps that the Times decided are the best food tracking apps for you. One is an old one. It's called MyFitnessPal.
That's probably the 800-pound gorilla.
Yeah.
I bet 25% of our listeners have that app on their phone right now, if not more.
Yeah, I'm one of them. I never use it, but because I used to use it for running. I mean, you could record, you know, the length of your runs each day and the, you know, your average
track
speed
your fitness
and all that kind of stuff. The New York Times rather says that this is good if you want social reinforcement, because I guess you can share those results with a bunch of people.
That's right, and we have the network effect going on. It is the most popular diet tracking app, so if you want to connect with your friends, statistically speaking, they're most likely to be on that app.
On that one, right? Yep, that's a good one. There's another one called Chronometer, and the Times says this is best if visuals are good, if you're big on visuals.
Yeah, this one gets very granular. It's a little bit of a later entry into the market, and it's for people that really want to drill down to the nth degree, and because they have so much data that they're tracking, this is not just about calories and protein. This is down to individual fatty acids and, you know, micrograms of this and that. Because they have so much data, they try to organize it for you visually in graphs just so you can help make sense of it. But this is really if you want to go deep.
Yeah, you got to be a person who's inclined to that.
Pretty wonky.
Because you could overwhelm yourself with data in this regard.
There's
one called Fat Secret, and the New York Times says that that's also good for granular metrics.
Mm-hmm. Right, and all three of these do more or less the same thing. You input everything that you eat. So one bowl of oatmeal, 4 ounces of orange juice, one chocolate chip cookie. That's your standard breakfast, isn't it?
Indeed.
And at the end of the day, it tells you how you did. It tells you how many calories you ate, maybe how much fiber you got, how much protein, whatever it is that you're interested in tracking.
So, I did that for like, not on this particular app, but maybe with MyFitnessPal. I did that for like a day. Because I mean, it was really hard to figure out how many, you know, calories and how many ounces of
estimate
strawberries did I have
says,
in the morning and stuff. That was hard.
It's very time consuming. And although it can be really helpful, that's exactly where it falls apart for a lot of people. That after a few days, they're like, oh, forget it. You know, I can't spend half my life looking up, you know, foods on my app and, you know, tracking everything. And it just becomes a little bit unsustainable.
And the other one that they include, this is the New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, is one that you yourself developed. Which is very interesting. So this is called the Nutrition GPA.
Yes.
Is that as in grade point average?
Exactly.
So you give people a letter grade at the end of every day.
Well, the interesting thing about the fact that the Nutrition GPA made the New York Times list is that it is completely different from the other three apps in that you do not log everything you eat every day. It kind of steps around that challenge. Instead, you just answer 10 yes or no questions about what you ate that day. So it takes about a minute to do it, and there's no measuring cups involved and scales involved. And then based on your answers to those questions, you get a grade for the day. And A-, B+, F, whatever. More importantly, it also keeps track of your grade point average over time. So it averages all your daily grades and then gives you a sort of cumulative look at how you're doing. And this is important because a lot of people focus overly on sort of their best day or their worst day and sometimes overestimate the impact that that those days have and are not really in touch with how things are kind of netting out on a typical daily average basis. So that's the other insight that gives you.
And so it is great in that you don't have to, you know, say I had 1.3 ounces of fish or something like that. But you do get this grade. So I downloaded this yesterday and I put in what I ate, or I answered the questions about what I ate, and I thought I was doing great. I thought this is fantastic, you know. And the one thing I fell short on was I had some processed meat. So I answered yes. The question was, did you have any processed meat or something? Because Joe Squared was the lunch for midday.
So you had some pepperoni.
And I had some pepperoni. So I had to say yes.
Yes.
So my grade was a B.
Hey, that's not
bad. I was
bad.
Devastated. Oh. I'm a hyperactive overachiever. I'm an A student, Monica, in some classes.
We do have grade inflation going on. But actually, the objective here is not to get an A every single day. That's not realistic. It's not necessary to have a perfect diet in order to have a healthy diet. So a B grade for a day is terrific. But what I would really be curious to see, Tom, is whether you can have a B cumulative nutrition GPA
average
after 30 days.
Right.
Yeah. Can you keep that grade point average up?
And if I had a B, or anybody who has this app has an A minus or a B plus grade point average, is that also likely to result in weight loss?
The app is not designed to promote weight loss, but what I use this in coaching groups that I use. So I've used it with thousands of people. And about a third to 40% of the people who use this app for 30 days do end up losing weight, even though it's just sort of an unintended, you know, usually happy side effect of this. So that's not the focus. We're not counting calories. We're not limiting portion sizes, but it does seem to have a beneficial effect in that as well.
You could flash your nutrition GPA at the Mensa meeting.
You can share it on Facebook if you want to.
All right. Nutrition GPA. It's Monica Reinagle's app. She is here. She is the nutrition diva. It's Smart Nutrition Today on Midday. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So there was a little bit of a mini scandal in your line of work, and that has to do with the Mediterranean diet. This is something that lots of folks have heard of.
Sure.
I've heard of it myself. It's, I guess, big on fruits and vegetables and fish.
All
and
the better things.
All the good stuff. And it's, you know, the people in Italy eat it all the time, and they're all in super great shape, evidently. And so there's a little bit of a thing about this. What's going on with the Mediterranean diet?
It was not about the Mediterranean diet per se. It was about probably the biggest and most famous study on the Mediterranean diet called the PREDIMED study. And this was published back in 2013 and has been cited by hundreds of studies as proof and evidence that the Mediterranean diet is all that. And what happened was some independent researchers took another look at the data and discovered that they broke a little rule in the way that they randomized their subjects. So that's a technical detail of how the study was designed and executed. They didn't follow the rule perfectly, and they were forced to retract the findings from this study. So this wasn't
never a good day if you're the author of a study.
You know, they were not the only study that caught up in this. There were about 10 other studies that kind of were also discovered through the same process to have made similar errors. They were just by far the biggest and most famous study. But really, this is a beautiful example of the scientific process working well. You know, because the data, there's transparency. The data is out there. Somebody else can come along who's not associated with your study and take a look at your results and check your math, you know, and find problems. And you know, that's a beautiful thing. But this wasn't, although this was an embarrassment for the investigators of the PREDIMED study, it was not an embarrassment for the Mediterranean diet, because once they discovered this error, they went back and they had to eliminate about 10% of the data that they had collected.
But it was a big study.
It was a big study.
And it went over many, many years.
That's right. It was over 7,000 people. They had to throw out the data, I believe, for somewhere around 700, so about 10%. That still left them with a huge sample size, more than enough to get valid results. And then they reanalyzed the data based on just what they had left, and the results were virtually identical.
Yeah.
So it didn't affect the outcome. This was more a corrective for the scientific process, for the publishing, you know, review process, and just...
And it worked.
Yeah. That's exactly right. So nobody needs to change anything they're doing based on this study, but it was, it was a very notable...
Yeah,
it's a big deal for a study like that have to be recalled.
There's a piece that Gina Colata wrote about this in the New York Times just last week, and I was really taken and chuckled with one of the investigators said, yeah, when we found out that we did this, you know, we worked nights and weekends and we got it figured out. We're like, wah, 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 wah. You know, he's just complaining about, now I have to work so hard to figure out what I did wrong. But it showed that they were taking it very seriously, and his entire lab was, you know, crunching these numbers and figuring it out.
These are European researchers. They all have 6 weeks of vacation every year.
So, that's right. We're not feeling sorry for them. So, but generally speaking, the Mediterranean diet is not a bad template to use if you're looking to eat healthy. I mean, there's nothing wrong. There's no bad stuff in that diet.
That's right. And, you know, we should also point out, though, that the Mediterranean diet has a ton of other research and studies that have been published on it, and they're all positive. That doesn't mean that this is the only healthy way to eat. It's just the best studied one. And there are other healthy dietary patterns which get a little bit less press. For example, just last week, there was a study on the Nordic diet. The traditional Nordic diet, which has a lot of similarities with the Mediterranean diet, heavy on the fruits
except
and
colder.
Vegetables, fish, right? The biggest difference is the source of fats. A lot less olive oil, a lot more dairy and marine fats. But the upshot was when you put together a diet based on mostly whole, unprocessed foods, it turns out to be a pretty healthy way to eat. And everything else is, you know, sort of details.
Yeah. If it comes in a plastic package, probably not a good idea.
That's
right. All right. It's Smart Nutrition today on Midday with the nutrition diva Monica Reinagle. We'll have a link to her website at WIPR.org/midday, where you can sign up for Monica's newsletter and get her nutrition news and tips by email. You can also ask Monica a question when we come back from a break. 410-662-8780, our email midday@WIPR.org, to send us a tweet at Midday WIPR, to follow me on Twitter at Tom Hall WIPR. You can also check us out on the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming. We'll be right back. Stick around.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR, where you're listening to Midday.
The JBs pass the peas. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday, and it's Smart Nutrition. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, a conversation about trends in small business incubation and economic development here in Baltimore. Josh Roussakis is the Baltimore Director for Venture for America. That's a program for young entrepreneurs. And one of those entrepreneurs, a guy named Floyd Jones of Velocity, will join us, along with Christy Weisgill of Johns Hopkins Technology Ventures. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. And looking ahead to Friday, it's Midday with the Mayor. Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh joins me for the hour. And by the way, on Monday, we'll have a conversation with the two candidates who are challenging Marilyn Mosby in the Democratic primary for state's attorney. Both Ivan Bates and Thiru Vignaraja will join me here in Studio A on Monday. Here on Midday, that's the day before the election. Early voting ends tomorrow at 8 o'clock. If you are just joining us today, as I mentioned, it's Smart Nutrition with the Nutrition Diva and regular Midday contributor Monica Reinagle. Monica blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. To join our conversation, if you have a question for Monica, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. To send us a tweet at Midday WIPR, and to catch us on the WIPR Facebook page, go to your smart device or your computer or your phone or your watch or your magic dish and check us out on Facebook. So one other thing, Monica, about the Mediterranean diet, I was interested in the piece about this, about the study thing that we were just talking about. In the Huffington Post, their headline was, "The Mediterranean diet only works if you're rich." And it's because basically the gist of it was because it's all fresh foods and fresh vegetables and fresh everything, as you said, you know, not processed food, that tends to be a little more costly than buying packaged and, you know, processed foods. Therefore, if you have the economic means to follow that diet, good for you, but there are a lot of people who don't. We talk about this with Lena Wen all the time. She comes in, these food deserts that we have here in Baltimore, all over the place, where it's, you know, it's an hour and two bus changes to get to a decent grocery store. Mm-hmm. So you end up buying food at the little bottega down the street. So, you know, the economics of nutrition are a real thing.
Yeah, that is true. Unfortunately, some of the cheapest calories that you can buy are some of the least healthful calories you can buy. So if you are food insecure, you know, you are going to be driven by sort of necessity and habit towards foods that are not really promoting your health, but they are keeping you fed. And that is a dimension that absolutely needs to be addressed if we want to try to spread healthier eating patterns more equitably throughout our society.
Yeah, we're going to spread some more grocery stores around our society. That's part of it. And then, you know, have the bottegas.
And create a culture in which, you know, folks know how to prepare healthy foods and know how to put together healthy diets. You know, we've in many households lost the cooking capacity. You know, we don't learn how to cook anymore.
The
cooking habit.
But also throw everything in the microwave and be done with it.
Well, a couple generations have gone by, and now people actually literally don't know how to cook. And so we got some work to do there as well.
I want to talk about calcium supplements.
Yeah.
This is interesting. The supplement business is huge. Mm-hmm. There are these stores all over the place. You can buy these things by the gallon.
Despite the fact that study after study shows that there's very little benefit from taking most of these nutritional supplements, you're right. The industry just continues to boom, probably due in large part to the boomers who are throwing everything that they can think of at the aging process and trying to slow that down.
To the tune of $32 billion by some estimates. I mean, it's really wild. But it turns out that there is some research just published this month that a calcium supplement might increase risk of polyps in your colon.
Yes. And this was especially surprising because a few years ago, there was a big meta-analysis done where they pooled the results from a lot of different studies to see if they could learn anything new that way. And they found in that meta-analysis that people who were taking calcium supplements had a very modestly reduced risk of colon cancer. And so I think the researchers who set up the study were probably expecting to confirm those results and see sort of the same thing, that the people taking calcium would have a lower incidence of polyps, which are not the exact same thing as colon cancer. It's sort of a precancerous stage. Most polyps do progress to colon cancer if they're not removed. And they were surprised after the five-year point of their study to see no difference, that the people taking the calcium did not have a lower incidence of polyps or colon cancer. But fortunately, that's not where the study stopped. They continued to follow these people for five more years.
This is a 10-year deal we're talking
about. That's right.
Yeah.
And after 10 years, they were shocked to see that the people who were taking the calcium supplements had three times the number of polyps discovered in their colon as the people who were not. That was surprising.
Yeah. So that it's a lot. It's worse, not better. And they were expecting it would be
modest benefit.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Now, the good news is because these people.
Now, as you say, a polyp is not necessarily cancerous.
That's right.
But, you know.
Right.
You can't get cancer without them.
That's
almost always true.
That's why we screen for polyps, you know, starting at age 50. And now I think they've actually moved that screening. They've proposed moving that benchmark down to 45 because they are discovering so much more colon cancer in younger people. That's why we screen for polyps, so that we can remove them before they turn into colon cancer. And the good news in this particular study is because all these folks were in this study, they were being followed very closely. And so those polyps were being removed and nobody went on to develop colon cancer. But that was a surprising finding. And this is not the first finding that we have showing that calcium supplementation is actually increasing various health risks. It is not a harm. It does not appear to be a harmless substance, especially in midlife, which is when most people take it.
Yeah, and in the $32 billion of the dietary and nutrition supplement business, calcium supplements are among the most popular.
Sure,
a lot of people take these things: calcium and vitamin D, and sometimes they're combined.
Correct.
This is one of the big sellers.
Well, it's also one of the ones that your doctor is most likely to recommend that you take.
We have an email from Barbara who says, can too much milk consumption be bad for you? She says, my 20-year-old son drinks little else besides 1% milk and occasionally a diet soda. And I've heard of the connection between calcium supplements and colorectal cancer, which runs in our family. So I'm very concerned. So is there a distinction between getting your calcium from milk or from food and getting your calcium from supplements?
Yes, there is. So I can set Barbara's mind at ease a little bit. In this same study and in most of the studies that I've reviewed, there is no link between the calcium that we get from actual foods and these health risks. The link appears to be with calcium supplements specifically.
Okay, so let's do a quick litany of the foods that are rich in calcium.
Dairy products in the Western world anyway are the primary source of calcium. So that's going to be milk, but also yogurt and cheese and cottage cheese and sour cream and all of that stuff. Some of the plant-based sources that are high in calcium for people that don't eat animal products, tofu is very high in calcium, not because soybeans are high in calcium, but in the process of making tofu, they use calcium sulfate to set it, to make it firm up and gel. So tofu has almost as much calcium per serving as a glass of milk. Bok choy, Napa cabbage, Chinese cabbage, those sorts of cruciferous vegetables are also really good sources of calcium. And then you get smaller amounts of calcium from all kinds of things, nuts, grains, little bits from vegetables. Fish has some calcium in it because in addition to the bones that we remove, there are tiny, tiny little bones that you don't see or sense when you're eating fish, and they, of course, are a good source of calcium.
So. And of course, and speaking of bones, that's one of the reasons lots of people take them, because osteoporosis is a concern for a lot of people, especially, as you say, the baby boomers. And so, you know, if you're trying to keep your bones strong, I mean, they're inclined to, you know, get more calcium.
Yeah, here's the thing, though. Getting a bunch more calcium in midlife does not really reduce your risk of osteoporosis or bone fractures. That was certainly the hope, and that's why so many doctors recommend it. But as more and more decades go by, we can see that it's just not having the impact that we thought it would, and it is having these harmful effects. Not only this new finding with the increased risk of colon polyps, but we've known for several years that especially women who take calcium supplements, they're the ones who are generally the most concerned about osteoporosis, have an increased risk of heart attacks and other cardiovascular complications. Kidney stones can be much more common, and those are not life-threatening usually, but awful darn painful.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want those. So for something that isn't actually producing a lot of benefit and is increasing our risk of harm, I think it's really time to rethink this sort of knee-jerk response to everybody should be taking 1,000 or 1,500 milligrams of calcium per day. That is almost certainly way too much to be taking as a supplement.
So the recommended intake for calcium, you write on your blog, about 1,000 to 1,300 milligrams. So that's when you're taking it with the supplements, but you can get 1,000 milligrams of calcium with, what, two glasses of milk or something? Is there a way?
Three, right. Uh-huh. Right, so that's how much calcium you're supposed to be getting from all sources. It's 1,000 milligrams until you get to a certain age, and then they bump it up a little bit to 1,300. But that's how much most people take as a supplement. People will take 1,000 milligrams or 1,500. Some people will take 2,000 milligrams. Most of the studies that we have on calcium supplementation were with these very high doses. So that means that people are, you know, almost doubling or tripling the amount of calcium. And doubling up on your calcium intake is not going to make your bones twice as strong.
Monica Reinagel is the Nutrition Diva. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. And you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page, where we are streaming as we speak. I'm Tom Hall. Of course, it also takes more than calcium for bone health, right? Bone health is not strictly related to calcium intake. There's other stuff that goes into this equation.
Right, and we should just back up a little bit and say that calcium intake can be absolutely critical for bone formation, but not when you're 50. It's in your teenage years, in your adolescence, through childhood and adolescence into the late teens, that is when calcium intake is critical. And unfortunately, that's a population that is very likely not to be getting enough calcium, either from their diet or from supplements. By the time people start paying attention in their 50s, you know, which is usually when their first parent breaks a hip,
Yeah, right.
And they're like, oh, no, you know what? And start taking that. It's too late. That ship has sailed. You need to have enough calcium, but you can't not make up for all the calcium that you didn't get in your youth. So one thing we can do is focus on that younger generation and try to build some healthy bones with calcium in those guys while we still have the opportunity to. But in midlife and beyond, yes, calcium is important. Vitamin D appears to be very critical. And then there's a whole range of other nutrients that go into healthy bones, including protein. That's one that's often overlooked. People tend to eat less and less protein as they get older, and for a variety of reasons, and that can contribute to bone loss. But I also think that this focus on calcium distracts us from other things that we could be doing that would probably help more. And the biggest thing, especially for people in midlife and beyond, is exercise. That is the most effective
vitamin way. X, as you've once called
That's
it.
That's right. That is the most effective way to strengthen and harden your bones as you are in midlife and getting older. Not only
weight-bearing exercise in particular, right?
That's right. And that doesn't...
Running, walking.
Exactly. Weight-bearing is almost a confusing term. That sounds like you have to be pumping iron. Weight-bearing just means you're bearing your body weight. So not swimming, not biking, but yes, running, yes, tennis, yes, walking even. And not only does that kind of exercise strengthen your bones, but it also improves your balance and your coordination, makes you a lot less likely to fall. And that's where fractures happen.
Yeah, and of course, when it comes to colorectal health, screenings at regular intervals, very important. I mean, you should
yes.
have colonoscopies. And you write very movingly about your own personal experience. You're a frequent flyer when it comes to colonoscopies.
Yes, I'm the poster child for screening. I went in, and I have no risk factors for colon cancer. Unlike Barbara, I do not
have... So no
have
genetic predisposition.
No colon cancer in my family. I exercise. I do all of the things you're supposed to do that lower your risk. My diet is not at all a risk factor for colon cancer. But I went in just to be a good girl, you know, and to do my screening. And I was stunned. They found a polyp, and it turned out to be kind of a big deal. I'm fine, and all is well. But, you know, had I put that screening off even for 2, 3, 4 years, as many people will do, because none of us look forward to that procedure, I could be in a very, very different situation right now. So I do try to take every opportunity to encourage people not to delay those screenings. They're not as bad as you think. And believe me, I have now had more than most of you ever will have to have.
Yeah, right. Because a normal interval is often 10 years.
That's right. If you go for your first screening and you get a clean bill of health, usually they don't want you back for 10 years. I have to go back significantly more frequently. But boy, compared to that, I'd rather have that
yeah.
than, you know, chemotherapy and surgery and
exactly.
all of the rest of it. So
yeah.
don't put that off. It's a very effective, life-saving procedure.
Get screened indeed. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will have more with Monica Reinagle. She is the Nutrition Diva. She's a licensed nutritionist who blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. You can come to our website, wipr.org/midday, and we'll have a link to subscribe to Monica's newsletter with her tips on nutrition and health. You can join us when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday_WIPR. Again, if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can find me @TomHallWIPR. And you can also find both Monica and me on the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming. We'll be right back. Stick around.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Pass the Peas by the JBs. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome back. It's midday. If you've just joined us, it's Smart Nutrition here on the program. The Nutrition Diva, Monica Reinagle, is here. She's a licensed nutritionist. She blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. I highly recommend you're checking it out. And if you'd like to ask Monica a question about anything you are interested in having to do with nutrition and health, you can give us a call at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email email, midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet @MiddayWIPR, and you can ping us on Facebook because we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So school is almost out for most kids. There are still a few who are
counting down.
Yeah, counting down the days, the hours. And you have written a thing in the Huffington Post about tips to avoid summer weight gain for kids. You know, we think, I said at the top of the show, we think about kids, you know, and the summer slide academically, because all of a sudden they're no longer doing math problems, and you know, they get back in September and can't remember how to subtract and divide. But summer is a problem when it comes to nutrition.
Right. You would think it would be exactly the opposite. They're out of school. They can be outside playing. The weather is nice. You know, there's plenty of fresh fruits and vegetables around in the summertime, and yet that doesn't seem to be how it works. We are seeing a disturbing trend of school-age kids gaining weight over the summer. And unfortunately, as so often the case, the kids who are already overweight and obese gain more than even the lean kids. But even the lean kids are gaining some weight over the summer. So that's something that we really want to get a We want to bite that, nip that in the bud.
Yeah, the American Academy of Pediatrics and the YMCA. A lot of it has to do with the amount of time that kids are spending playing video games and
That's
watching
right.
the tube.
Yeah, and on their tablets and on their phones. Screen time is a major influence here. And the Academy of Pediatricians recommends that we set a limit of 2 hours per day for kids for all screen time. That includes movies, television, video games, you know, phones and tablets, you know, all combined 2 hours a day.
Yeah, get outside, get a little sunlight, get some rays. Yeah. It's ironic, isn't it? Because it's a sort of a knee-jerk understanding of the nutritional value of school lunches as being not so great.
That's right.
You know, mystery meat and, you know, French fries and pizza.
Yes, we wring our hands a lot about the school lunches.
And then it turns out perhaps on some weird level, school lunches are more healthy than what kids are eating at home during the day in the summer.
Yeah, a lot of school districts have removed the soda machines. They no longer sell any sugar sweetened beverages in the schools. And unfortunately, that's not always the case at home.
Yeah. Interesting.
And, you know, and it's just sort of an all day grazing opportunity where at school, at least the eating opportunities are somewhat confined, you know, to set times. There's a little bit more of a schedule that goes on that all of those things seem to work in our favor. So, yes, ironically, sometimes the availability of unhealthful snacks and especially beverages can be greater and opportunity to consume them is greater at home than it is at school. And often kids are have a lot more unsupervised time.
Right.
You know, and
well, shout out to all the cafeteria ladies.
That's right.
The good job that they're doing keeping our kids fit. So you have this 5-point suggestion, you know, list of suggestions. And one of them, you mentioned schedule. Schedule really is important. So the uniformity of a kid's day matters a lot. And if that uniformity gets messed up, perhaps they'll, you know, find themselves eating at weird times and eating weird stuff.
That's right. And, you know, it's not that we have to turn summer into a hyper-regimented time. And summer schedules are often different than school day schedules. Kids get to sleep a little bit later. Maybe they stay up a little bit later in the evenings. Maybe mealtimes shift because even though the parents don't get out of school for the summer unless they're teachers, you know, the whole family's schedule shifts a little bit. And all of that is fine. But trying to keep some sort of loose schedule in place, especially for mealtimes, can help cut down on just the constant snacking and the sort of unplanned meals and foods that really can add up to more than people realize, you know, and also just trying to maintain some sort of regular sleeping habits is important for everybody, not just kids. Even if those schedules have shifted a little bit later because of the summer and because they don't have to get up so early for school, still trying to make sure that they are getting to bed at about the same time every night and, you know, getting up more or less the same time every morning. That has a really big impact on people's appetite and mood and energy levels, and all of that plays into how much we feel like we want to eat and what we want to eat.
So keep dinner time around the same time,
bedtime
around the same, even if it's different than what bedtime is during school
year. That's right.
But keep it as long as they're consistent.
And try to make sure that there are some loosely scheduled meal time. So breakfast you know, lunch, maybe there's a snack in there, especially if dinner is a little bit later, and not just have it be sort of an all-day buffet.
Yeah. My wife, Linnell Smith, is a senior editor at Johns Hopkins, and she's written about, and she even wrote about this years ago when she was writing for the Baltimore Sun, about the chronobiology, about when you take pills, when you mm-hmm. eat food, when you have intake of this, that, or the other thing. And there's been some studies about that. I mean, I have a friend who says, well, the way I lose weight is I just make sure I never eat after 7:30 at night.
Yeah.
You know, and he's got this, like, regiment that he says, I'm gonna drop some pounds. I just stop at 7:30, wherever I am, whatever I'm doing, I don't eat.
Right. Well, when you think about what you tend to eat between 7:30 and bedtime, it's usually not the healthiest calories of the day. But it is true that shifting your meal times earlier in the day can sometimes lead to weight loss, even if you don't. Now I'm talking about adults. You know, even if you don't eat less, simply eating it earlier in the day can sometimes result in modest weight loss. So that the chronobiology is absolutely a real thing.
Interesting. You talk about activity during the summer. I mean, if the kids do stay active, that's going to help, obviously. And that's sort of a no-brainer. But sometimes, you know, mom and dad, you know, if it's an 8-year-old, the 8-year-old may not be inclined to, you know, seek out these opportunities on her own. I mean, sometimes you're going to have to figure out, okay, you're going to go outside and play for 2 hours.
Sure.
Leave.
Right. And, you know, sometimes just getting them involved in some sort of organized rec league, you know, to play softball or kickball, dodgeball, you know, whatever it is, you know, some sort of organized sports that happen at a specific time of day can help make sure that it actually happens. That way you don't have to worry about going outside to play and not being able to find anybody, you know, to play with. And of course, that also gives them something to do instead of the screen time. It's kind of hard to lock down the screens when there's no alternative. And so having some organized sports or play or active activities to fill that gap is kind of a twofer. Then it also helps, you know, but the whole family can be a little bit more active. There are ways to spend time together in the evenings or on the weekends, you know, that involve movement. And so sometimes it's also helpful for the parents to shift their kind of, you know, what would be fun to do, you know, tonight. Maybe instead of going to a baseball game, you know, we'll go down to Fort McHenry and toss a Frisbee around or, you know, ride our bikes.
Because I've talked to a number of families with young kids who have particular times during the week where all screens are turned off. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a little radical to me, but, you know, like Friday night at 6 o'clock, no phones, no tablets, no television, no nothing until Saturday at, you know, 4 o'clock or something mm-hmm. like that. And everybody
sort of
sticks to
digital Sabbath.
It's a digital Sabbath, right? Yeah. And of course, if that were the rule in my house, I would die.
No, you
I
wouldn't.
I would die, Monica. I would die.
That would be challenging
for
me, too.
Oh, my God, I can't get the AP feed on my phone. I would die. But, you know, it is something. I mean, sometimes because we are so used to staring at these darn things, it really does take a concerted effort to say we are not going to be on a screen. And if you're a little kid, you can understand the appeal of that. Oh, yeah, I want to watch another movie. I want to play another game.
Sure. And you can understand the appeal for parents because the kids are occupied and blissfully quiet and they don't need anything.
The video babysitter.
And, it is very challenging to put away screens. And I think the adults who enforce those kinds of, you know, decide they're going to do that for the benefit of the kids get a lot of benefit out of that if they also play by the same rules. Because, as you say, you know, we are unlikely to enforce those kinds of austerities on ourselves. But sometimes if we're doing it for our kids, we can get some benefit out of that, too.
You've talked about in your list of getting the kids involved with healthy cooking and healthy eating. We talked about how cooking is sort of no longer a habit, but the cooking and preparing foods and buying the fresh foods and stuff can be an entertaining endeavor.
This is really one of my favorite ways to go about this. And I don't have children, but I have nieces and nephews. And since they have been very, very tiny, when they visit me or when I visit them, what we do together is cook, you know, or go to the farmer's market. Or if they're at my house, we'll go out and plant something in the garden or pick something from the garden. So I've sort of trained them from an early age to expect some sort of cooking project. It's such a fun way to spend time with kids. And kids love that. Kids love to cook. And kids also actually like to garden, you know?
Yeah.
And it is a very effective way to get them interested in healthy foods. You know, you want to see a kid excited about a green bean, you give them a square foot of earth and give him a green bean and let him grow his own, and that's all he's going to want to eat So he's going to be waiting to pick those green beans. So, yeah, teach kids, cook with your kids, you know. And that's another thing that the adults get the collateral benefit from.
Exactly. You know. My daughter and I cooked together all the time when she was growing up.
Well, you're a great cook.
Well, I like to cook. And in our house, I like to cook more than Linnell does. So that's fine. And so, but Miranda and I, our daughter, we cooked all the time. And now she's a very good cook.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she and her partner cook all the time. And, you know, they also, you know, go to the farmer's markets and they get this.
She's got that kitchen confidence.
Yeah, because she's been doing it since she was little. So, it's fun. The other thing, and this seems also, again, very obvious, but really smart, is make the healthy choice the easy choice. And this is like product placement in the grocery store.
You
can do the same thing in your refrigerator.
That's exactly what it is. It's, you know, just behavioral economics. And the grocery stores use this to get us to buy the foods that they make the highest profit margin on. But we can use the exact same techniques to get our kids and ourselves to eat the foods that give us the highest nutritional profit margin, if you will. And so really what that means is put the stuff that you want your kids to eat and that you want yourself to eat front and center. Have the bowl of fruit on the table or on the counter in the kitchen. When you open that refrigerator door, don't be staring at a wall of, you know, soda and other stuff. Make sure that what you're seeing are the healthy snacks, the raw vegetables, the sparkling water, you know, whatever it is that you're trying to sell, whatever you're trying to move off your particular shelf, put it front and center. Have it be easier to get to than, you know, the stuff that you'd rather, you know, put that other stuff out of sight.
Got a couple of other questions about some things that we talked about earlier in the show. Here's an email from Chris. Is calcium carbonate any better as a calcium supplement?
That is the most common form of calcium supplementation. It's the cheapest. It is not, is no better or worse. And most of the research on calcium supplementation, including the stuff that finds these negative impacts, is going to be using calcium carbonate because it is the most prevalent one. So I think, you know, the different forms of calcium are going to be equivalent. The real take home here with what we were talking about earlier is to try to get as much of your calcium as you can from foods.
Yeah,
and then
food.
If you're not quite meeting the recommended intake, just use a supplement. Calcium carbonate is fine or any other, but only take enough to fill the gap. You don't need to then pile on an extra 1,000, 1,500 milligrams on top of what you're already eating.
There's a listener in Towson who said, where did this idea come from that drinking almond milk or soy milk is better than cow's milk? I worry that we're all eating too much soy, and if it isn't organic, it's probably treated with chemicals like everything else.
Well, there has been a big move towards plant-based diets, and many people have decided to back down on dairy. And so these alternate milks have kind of come in to fill that gap, because I guess people need something to put on their cereal or something to put, you know, in their coffee. And each of them have pros and cons. One of the pros of soy milk as an alternative to dairy is that it has just about as much protein as cow's milk. And all of the other alternative milks are very low in protein, such as almond milk, almost no protein. But one important thing, because dairy is our primary source of calcium in the American diet, if you decide for whatever reason you don't want to drink cow's milk and you're going to choose one of those other types of milk, definitely look for one that contains, that they've added some calcium to, so that you're at least, you know, getting that from your diet.
All right, we have another question about post delivery, post maternity nutrition, which we don't have time to get to, but it's on Facebook, so we'll make sure that you find it and you can answer Leah, who had a question about that.
Happy to.
But our time is done here, so thank you so much, and we shall see you the next time. Appreciate
it. You're welcome. Great to see you.
This has been another edition of Smart Nutrition here on Midday with Monica Reinagel, the Nutrition Diva. She is a licensed nutritionist who blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. If you come to wipr.org/midday, we'll have a link so you can sign up for Monica's newsletter. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, developing the entrepreneurs of the future. Josh Roussakis of Venture for America, Floyd Jones of Velocity, and Christy Weiskill of Johns Hopkins Technology Ventures Program joins me to talk about economic development and developing the talent that will animate the next generation of business here in Baltimore. We want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. I'm sure it's healthy. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. A reminder, early voting in the primaries ends tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Polls are open today until 8 o'clock. Election day is next Tuesday. WIPR will have complete coverage of primary night in Maryland. I'll be in Studio A with guest commentators and reports from the field from members of the WIPR news team. Our coverage begins at 9 o'clock on election night next Tuesday night. We'll be back for midday tomorrow. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. Have a great day.